Chapter 10 A full moon was high overhead, casting just enough light onto the street to navigate by. Deep shadows clung to squat brick buildings and warehouses on either side of the road. Railroad tracks inlaid into the asphalt beside the main street branched off at each intersection, leading into enormous loading warehouses designed to house train cars. The air was humid, still, and quiet, making the horses' steel shoes seem impossibly loud as they struck the pavement. Kenny sat on his horse, reins held in one hand, his other hand resting on the butt of his pistol as he rode down the middle of the street into the industrial section of Charleston. His mother's horse followed just behind him, lashed to his own horse and carrying her limp form slung over the saddle. She was bound, gagged, and had a burlap sack pulled over her head. Her hands and feet were tied to the saddle, and she gave a convincing grunt of protest and discomfort every once in a while, completing the appearance that Kenny was a kidnapper bringing in his prey in exchange for money. A short distance into the industrial section, he located the old soda manufacturing plant the highwayman Bill Cheswold had told him about. The building was 100 feet wide, several 100 feet long, and tall enough to accommodate a train car into the large, open loading bays located at the side of the building. Kenny led the horse down the side street, peering into the shadows for any sign of Bill's contact. "Hey, you! Stop!" a gruff voice called to him from the darkness. Kenny pulled his horse up short, looking around in the darkness, trying to determine where the voice had come from. "Show yourself!" A match flared in the darkness and lit a kerosene lantern, dispersing the darkness and revealing the faces of two men in Martin Hale Security Company uniforms. They were tough-looking. One of them had a scar running the length of his cheek, its pale line standing out in stark contrast to his skin. The other man, who held the lantern, was a huge brute, his eyes dull and unintelligent, yet cruel and dangerous-looking.
"Kid, you'd better turn that horse around and get on out of here. You're going to get yourself into trouble," the scar-faced man said menacingly.
Kenny swallowed to wet his dry throat. Summoning his courage, he slid down from his horse and gave the man a look of disdain. If he was to play the part of a kidnapper believably, he was going to have to show them that he wasn't someone they could push around. He took the lead of his mother's horse and led the animal into the light, illuminating his cargo.
"Why? I'm right where I want to be."
"Who the hell are you, kid? What are you doing here?" Scarface asked again.
"Bill sent me. I'm supposed to bring this woman here and collect the pay," Kenny said.
The Martin Hale men looked at each other, obviously suspicious. The brute cocked his head to the side and pointed his finger at Kenny accusingly.
"Tell us what you're really doing here or I'm gonna beat your little ass to a pulp."
Kenny slid the Glock halfway out of its holster, making sure both of the men could see his action.
"Is there a problem here, guys? 'Cause Bill is going to be pissed off if I have to go fetch him just to convince your dumbass I'm with the program. Your choice, though,"
Kenny said.
"Is that right? I don't recall him mentioning anything about bringing on more people," Scarface pressed.
Kenny remained silent, staring down the two men, his Glock at the ready. Scarface smirked and turned to the brute.
"Damn, this kid is ice cold. A stone-cold killer. He's cool."
Scarface then turned to Kenny and nodded his head with respect.
"You're one hardcore kid. No wonder Bill brought you on. All right, let's take a look at what you brought."
The two men approached his mother's horse, and the big brute yanked the burlap sack off of her head. Amy gave a muffled scream and shook her head wildly. The man opened his eyes wide and gave a crude catcall, the whistle echoing loudly.
"Huh. Usually Bill sends us fresh meat. She's older."
The scar-faced man gave an evil cackle.
"Where'd you find her, kid? She's old enough to be your mother. The hell if I'm paying the usual price for her."
The brute leaned in close to Amy's face and squinted, holding the kerosene lamp close.
"Hey, she looks just like you, kid. What are you trying to—"
Lightning fast, Kenny pulled his Glock out and had it leveled at the two men before they could even blink.
"Don't move. Step back from the horse where I can see you. Keep that lantern up. Both of you raise your hands in the air and don't move a muscle."
The men backed up, anger and confusion written on their faces. With a quick glance behind him, Kenny reached over and helped his mother remove the ropes binding her legs together. With a twist of her wrists, the rope binding her hands unraveled and slipped off. She slid off the horse and frisked the two men, confiscating two pistols and a long knife.
"Let's go inside and have a talk," Kenny said.
The two men turned and entered the building through the open bay door, then walked several feet into the cavernous warehouse.
"That's far enough. Put the lantern on the floor and then sit down and put your hands on top of your head," Kenny said.
His mother pulled the heavy metal bay door shut, which made a low rumbling noise as the door slid along a set of tracks and then slammed shut with an echoing boom. Amy walked over to a mechanic's tool chest parked near a workbench and rooted around, taking a handful of plastic zip ties out of a tray. She moved over to the men, moved the lantern several feet away from them, and then circled around behind them, binding their hands behind their backs with the zip ties. Kenny joined his mother and took a deep breath, calming his pounding heart before he began his line of questioning. Sarah's life was on the line. She was everything to him. He couldn't mess this up. He had to get these men to tell him what happened to her, and fast. The more time that he let pass, the less chance there was he would find her. He decided the direct approach would be best. There was no time for teasing out bits of information a piece at a time.
"You,"
Kenny said, nudging Scarface with his pistol.
"We already know that you buy people from Bill Cheswold. He told us all about it. A few days ago, Bill brought my fiancée here and sold her to you. You're going to tell me where she is."
The scar-faced man threw his head back and gave an evil cackle.
"Kid, I ain't telling you shit."
"Her name is Sarah. She's 18. She has long blonde hair and..."
Brute gave Kenny a vile look and shouted,
"We ain't telling shit to you. You ain't nothing."
"Mom, break the big dumb one's fingers. Start with his pinky."
The big man cursed and spit on the floor dismissively. When his mother leaned down behind him and took hold of his pinky finger,
"Lady, you ain't going to do shit."
"Last chance," Kenny said.
The man remained mute, but the sweat pouring from his forehead showed his fear. A few seconds passed in silence.
"Do it,"
Kenny said. A sickening crack was followed by the man's scream of pain.
"Ah, shit,"
the scar-faced man cried. His mouth hung open, clearly rattled. When the big brute's cries of agony subsided, Kenny squatted down in front of the scar-faced man.
"Let's try this again. Tell me what you did with Sarah."
"Man, I just started here yesterday. I didn't know what was going down. I haven't done anything wrong. I wasn't even here when Bill brought those two in and..."
"Liar! You just said those two. I only mentioned my fiancé. You were here when Bill brought Sarah and her brother."
Kenny turned to his mother.
"Start with his thumb."
His mother leaned down and pried the man's thumb out from his balled-up fists as he attempted to keep her from getting at his fingers. With a merciless grunt, she used both hands and jerked the thumb backward. The scar-faced man screamed in a loud, shrill voice. His thumb stuck up at an awkward angle, twitching. Kenny stood up and then squatted down in front of the big brute. The man's forehead dripped with sweat, his eyes as wide with fear.
"Your turn again, big guy. What did you do with Sarah, the girl that was brought here the other day?"
All right. Please don't..." "Shut up and don't say a word. You're going to get us both killed if you tell them anything,"
the scar-faced man said. The brute bit his lip and looked at the floor, his lower lip quivering.
"Don't be stupid, guys. You're going to tell me everything you know. It's just a matter of how many broken fingers you walk away with,"
Amy said. She leaned down and seized one of the brute's fingers and snapped it. Kenny shouted to be heard over the brute's screaming.
"Let's keep going with the big guy. I bet he breaks first."
"No, please, no more. I'll tell you whatever you want to know,"
the big brute said. He didn't look so intimidating now. Tears streamed down his cheeks and drool dripped from his lower lip as he blubbered for mercy.
"So, talk," Kenny said.
"Bill came in here bragging about a big haul. He told us his gang took out some people that were loaded. He said they got horses, whiskey, gold, and all kinds of good stuff. That young guy he brought, we put him in on a train and sent him down the tracks. The girl, we sent her on a different train."
"Where?"
Kenny demanded.
"Where was the train going?"
"To Huntington. I don't know what they do with the girls. All I know is a boat comes to pick them up once a week. I don't know where they go after that."
"How long ago did you send her there?" Kenny asked.
2 days.
His mother shot him a look of concern. 2 days was a long time. Too long. She could be anywhere by now. Kenny's hands began to tremble and his body flushed with heat. These men disgusted him. How could you take a human being and treat them like an animal, buying and selling them? He knew Sarah's brother had been sent to a coal mine. Kenny was filled with fear, wondering what they had planned for Sarah. He had to deal with these men and then find her fast.
How long has this been going on? How many people have been bought and sent down the railroad?
Don't tell them shit, Scarface said.
Kenny stood up and kicked the Scarfaced man hard in the gut, silencing him.
I've been here 6 months. They've been doing this a long time before me. I don't know how many people. I just don't know.
Amy turned to Kenny, stunned. It had been 3 years since the EMP, since the lawlessness started everywhere. Could it really have been that long? How many people had this kidnapping ring taken in the past 3 years? He would end this right here and now. Nobody else was going to go through what Sarah and her brother had been through. He walked around behind the two men, put his Glock in the holster, and took his knife out.
You're selling people into slavery. I can't let you keep doing that. There are families missing their loved ones because of what you've done.
He put the knife against the man's neck.
Wait, please, Scarface pleaded. I can tell you.
Just then the bay door opened and several men in Martin Hale uniforms walked through the door carrying kerosene lanterns, casting light on Kenny and his mother. The men stopped just inside the door, taking in the scene.
What the hell is going on here? Grab those two,
one of the Martin Hale men yelled. The group of men surged forward, clubs and bars in hand. Kenny pulled his Glock and fired a few hasty shots in their direction, causing the men to hit the floor. He turned and ran towards the back of the warehouse, hastily looking over his shoulder to see Amy running just behind him. He ran through a maze of old machinery, shelving, and crates until he found an access door on the side of the building and ran outside.
Come on, let's get to the horses, Amy said.
He ran as fast as he could, pausing to fire at the pursuing men as they came through the door he and his mother passed through seconds ago. As they rounded the corner, they saw their horses standing right where they'd left them. Kenny wasted no time. Launching himself into the saddle, he spurred his horse on at a full gallop down the empty street. He turned to check that his mother was still with him and fired several shots to keep the men from pursuing. The pursuers fell further and further behind, unable to keep up with the horses. Some distance down the road, Kenny turned onto a side street and raced out of town. His heart pounded like a drum from the pursuit. But as he caught his breath and his adrenaline rush subsided, he had only one thing on his mind. Sarah. What did they do with her? Was she still in Huntington? 100 equally terrifying situations unfolded in his mind. He pushed all of them aside and forced his mind to focus on what needed to be done.
Kenny, are you all right?
Amy asked. He nodded mutely, his mind fully focused on the path ahead. He would follow the train tracks to Huntington, to the end of the line. Chapter 11. At the helm of the Dawn Till Dusk, Captain O'Donnell gauged the distance to the approaching dock with an experienced eye. She spun the wheel hard to the left and cut the riverboat's power, letting momentum and the river's current carry the riverboat the rest of the way in a well-practiced maneuver. As the boat gently sidled up to the dock, her crew tossed ropes over large cleats on its edge, then pulled the ropes taut and tied them off with a cleat hitch. The riverboat secure, the crewman laid down a gangway plank and prepared to offload the ship's cargo. Captain O'Donnell went through a shutdown checklist and gathered her ship's logs and paperwork. She had a meeting today with her biggest customer. If she could renew the contract and secure a 2-year extension, there would be enough work in the pipeline to think about building a third boat. One with a newer and better-designed steam engine. The first two were of her design, after all, and she was admittedly more of a tinkerer than an engineer. She needed a ship with a more efficient setup, one that would use less coal and reduce fuel costs. Coal had been abundant and dirt cheap last year when there were still numerous small railroad companies shipping coal to port cities on the Ohio River, all competing for the same business. Since the Appalachian Express Railroad Company had bought out all the competition and consolidated their shipping network, coal cost 3 times what it used to. Angry shouts down at the dockside distracted her from her work. Patty leaned out the window of the wheelhouse to see what the issue was. The dockmaster was shouting at her oldest son, Pete, and pointing at the mooring securing the riverboat to the dock. From what she could tell, he was telling Pete to let the lines loose and cast off, something about another riverboat due in at any moment. Captain O'Donnell sighed and grabbed her things. This was probably just another bit of drama cooked up by the dockmaster to justify the grift he demanded from ships entering his port. She didn't mind greasing the wheels to move things along more quickly, but the man was becoming a pain in the ass. She descended the stairs to the main deck and crossed the gangplank, interrupting the shouting match by stepping between the two men.
"Gentlemen, what seems to be the issue here?"
"O'Donnell, you've got to get this boat out of here. We've got another boat due in any minute carrying priority cargo for Anchor Riverboat. You're going to have to come back tomorrow," the red-faced dockmaster said.
Anchor Riverboat Company. Just hearing the company's name was enough to put her in a foul mood. That bastard Tweed had been pushing every captain on the river out of business, creating a monopoly for himself.
"I seem to remember reaching a friendly agreement with you last year to make sure we would always be welcome in Huntington. I'm surprised to run into an issue like this."
"Don't get me wrong, Captain O'Donnell. We did have an agreement, but things have changed. I've got other arrangements now with bigger shipping companies. They push a lot of business through this dock, and when they say they need access, I've got to deliver. Just look around. Anchor has got tons of cargo on this dock. Come back."
"Speaking of cargo, I don't see any of my customers' cargo ready for loading. Know anything about that?"
she asked, pointing at the staging areas in an asphalt parking lot just off the dock. The areas had large billboards noting which cargo was bound for what destination, the riverboat carrying the cargo, and the due date. All three staging areas advertised cargo being transported by Anchor Riverboat Company. None of it was marked for her ship. Something was definitely up.
"I don't know anything about that. You'd have to talk to the market clerk. All I do is make sure it gets on the right boats," the dockmaster said.
"What would it take to unload our cargo today? I've got contracts to fulfill. I can't keep my customers waiting. My word as a captain is at stake if I don't deliver on time. I always deliver on time."
"It's not a matter up for discussion. You have to move your..."
Fatty opened the drawstrings of her purse and shook a few gold coins out into her palm, watching the dockmaster's eyes light up at the gold shining brightly in the sunlight.
"Seeing as I'm already here, maybe you could find a reason that we can't move our boat just yet. We'll unload and be underway as soon as we can,"
she said, suggestively. The dockmaster glanced around and then took the coins from her palm.
I think we can make an exception. You're having some engine issues and can't leave the dock yet, if I heard you right. I'll let one of the other boats know. They need to make way."
The dockmaster marched down the dock, harassing another riverboat.
"What was that all about?" Pete asked.
"You let me worry about that. See that the cargo gets unloaded."
Captain O'Donnell walked into town, heading for the port's shipping clerk, Mark Schwartz. The title was misleading. He was in charge of the entire port, responsible for overseeing client contracts and ensuring suppliers moved their goods in a timely manner. He had over 100 porters and dozens of security men at his disposal, as well as having complete discretion over how the dock was run. She'd worked with the man frequently over the last couple of years. He was impersonal and a bit standoffish, but if anybody knew what was going on, it would be him. A short ways down the street, she entered the shipping clerk's office. The heat was stifling in the enclosed building. The clerk sat behind the only desk in the office, furiously writing in a notepad, his nose bent close to his work. He didn't stop writing or look up from his work as he addressed her.
"Yes, what can I do for you?"
"How are you, Mark?"
Captain O'Donnell asked.
"Hot. I'm very busy. What do you need?"
"I was just down at the docks and my cargo isn't in the staging area. Can you tell me where it is?"
"Who is your contract with?"
Mark asked flatly.
"Schneider Farms. There should be 30 pallets of tobacco waiting for me."
The clerk glanced at her and then opened a filing cabinet, flipping through a file folder. He pulled a piece of paper out and set it on the desk, pointing to the line reading O'Donnell Shipping, crossed out in red ink, with a signature next to it.
"Schneider canceled the contract with you. That cargo has already been shipped by another ship. You don't have any cargo."
"When did this happen? I've been shipping for them for 2 years. Old man Schneider never expressed any issues to me."
"That's not my business.
Do you need anything else?
Who shipped the tobacco? She said.
That's not any of your concern, Mark said.
I can take a guess who did. Tweed is pushing me out too, huh? The bastard's got 3 boats out there.
Mark glanced nervously at the open door, as if afraid to be seen talking to her.
Is there anything else you need? I'm very busy.
No, I think I get the picture.
Patty left the office and walked up the main street, taking note of more than a few dark glares cast in her direction from Tweed's porters. She ignored their stares and made her way to the Malden Salt Company's satellite office 2 blocks down the road. The loss of the Schneider's shipping contract wasn't a devastating loss, but it would cost her money. The trip wasn't a complete waste, though. She still needed to purchase salt for her fishery. It would occupy a quarter of the riverboat's cargo holds and would last the fishery for the next 2 or 3 months. As soon as she opened the door, she knew something was wrong. The Malden Salt representative was not his usual chipper self, eager to carry on small talk. His cheeks went bright red at her appearance.
Captain O'Donnell, it's good to see you. Please come in and have a seat. Let me get you a drink, he said. I don't have time for a drink today. I'm here to buy salt. This is quite awkward. I don't know how to put this, but I'm afraid we aren't selling to the public any longer. One of our larger clients has made arrangements for exclusive rights to all of our salt production, he said, wringing his hands. I'm sorry for the inconvenience.
The harassment at the docks and the loss of the Schneider contract weren't big issues, but this was another matter altogether. Without salt, work at the fishery would slow to a crawl. Smoking fish took far longer and required more work than salt curing them. There wasn't another salt mine within 100 miles of here. Without the salt, the future of her company was in dire straits.
What company bought exclusive rights? Do you know what this means for me? For all of the little businesses that purchased directly from you?
She asked.
I'm afraid that information is confidential, as part of the agreement. I'm tremendously sorry that... Forget it. We both know who has the contract. Why bother pretending? Tweed is going to sell the salt now, and prices are going to skyrocket, just like coal prices did. Tweed is going to bend us little people over the barrel until there isn't a dime left to squeeze out of us.
The salt salesman looked down at the floor, unwilling to meet her glare. Patty stormed back to the docks. Upon arrival, her mood grew even darker. A gray-haired cop had her son, Pete, pushed against the boat, holding him there with the end of his baton. Several of Tweed's porters stood behind the cop, staring down her son. As she approached, her crew began to pour off the dawn till dusk and surround Pete, their fists clenched, muscles tensing. Whatever the cause of this, she needed to put a stop to it right now. Tweed owned this town now. That much was readily apparent. There was no point in letting her boys get baited into a fight they had no chance of winning. If the fight happened, Tweed's men would go free, and her own would be thrown in a cell.
"Officer, what can I do for you? Some of these boys acting up?" she asked.
The cop turned to her, his eyes cold as ice. "Your men were starting trouble, giving these porters a hard time. I don't want to hear any more from your crew today, or I'll haul their asses to jail. Understand?"
"Understood. It's the heat, officer. They get too worked up when it's this hot out. As soon as we unload, we'll be on our way," she said.
Turning to Pete, she yelled harshly,
"Get back on the boat. I told you to stay out of trouble."
The cop smirked and glared at Pete for a moment, then left the dock with the Tweed porters in tow. Once they were gone, she turned to her son. Her expression softened.
"Pete, get those last few crates unloaded, and then get ready to cast off. We're getting out of here."
"We didn't do anything at all. The men were busy."
Patty held her hand up and shook her head.
"I already know you didn't do anything wrong. You don't have to explain. That cop was looking for an excuse to throw you and the crew in jail. Get them back to work. We're leaving as soon as the rest of the cargo is offloaded."
"What about our pickup and the salt?" he asked.
"Just do as I ask," she said.
Pete nodded and went back to work, a confused look on his face. He was a good second in command and knew better than to question her once she had given an order. He put the men back to work and then set about preparing the riverboat for departure. She knew he would hold his questions until later, when they were alone. She had questions of her own that needed answering. And soon, if the family business was to survive. Tweed was pushing them out. The dawn till dusk was no longer welcome in Huntington, and she suspected it would be the same at the other port towns along the Ohio River for 200 miles in either direction where Anchor Riverboat shipped. He'd already pushed everyone else out of the business and had now turned his sights on her. Ruthless and unethical, how was she going to compete with him? Her shipping contracts were gone. Cutting off her supply of salt was a smart move, a killing blow. He had left her with no way to make a livable profit with her boats. The cargo unloaded, Pete called out the all clear as the crew cast off the mooring lines and stepped from the pier to the riverboat. She put the Dawn Till Dusk into gear and felt the powerful engine propel the boat forward against the river's swift current. She set course for home, glad to be away from Huntington with her crew intact. Whatever other nasty surprises Tweed had for her in the town would have to wait. She knew better than to hang around and fight when the odds weren't in her favor. They would steam home and use the travel time to think of a way out of this disaster. Her entire family depended on her to make the hard decisions, and at the moment, she was hard-pressed on how to proceed. Chapter 12 Chief Bud Howell woke up drenched in sweat, his head pounding like a drum. He closed his eyes and tried to go back to sleep, hoping to sleep off his epic hangover. But sunlight poured in from an open window, hitting him square in the eyes. He rolled over and stuffed his face into a pillow. A sour smell met his nose, rank and unfamiliar. Gagging, he pushed himself up off of the bed, confused. His head was spinning, and he looked around, wondering where he was. A motel. A nasty, cheap motel room. He couldn't remember anything that happened after leaving Mount Olive State Penitentiary and his meeting with Warden Metz. How he got here, he hadn't a clue. Some combination of riding an intelligent horse and dumb luck. Regardless, the cramped room was hot, humid, and had an unbearable odor that didn't help his nauseated stomach. Howell opened the door, shielding his eyes against the glaring sun. His eyeballs felt as if they would split in two, but it was better than the heat and the smell of the room. An elderly woman carrying an armload of towels and washcloths stopped when she saw him.
Good morning. Can I get you anything?
Water. Unless you have some coffee stashed away.
Coffee? I'd kill for a cup of joe,
the elderly woman chuckled.
Just the water, then, Chief Howell said.
The dizziness had subsided, and he retrieved the leather-bound notebook and stack of papers he'd lifted from Warden Metz's office. He took the items outside and sat down in a chair on the motel's porch. He flipped open the notebook, looking at the columns and rows of a handwritten ledger. It had a running balance on the far right-hand column, and a numeric amount under the shipped column. There was no mention of what it was being shipped. There was only a date, an amount, and a sum of money. The total balance grew over time, and it had the appearance of a list of deposits. His curiosity grew. Was the warden getting paid by somebody for something? The amount of money was staggering, far more than a warden's paycheck. Whatever the old Warden Dodson was keeping track of, he didn't want it on the record if his notebook was found. It was interesting, but unhelpful. Howell set the journal aside and browsed the looted invoices. There were shipping bills, invoices for goods, bills for service rendered, payment receipts, and inventory statements from Mount Olive's vendors. The invoices spanned several years. Something interesting leaped out at him as his mind absorbed the details. The year after the EMP, the prison changed over nearly all of the vendors it did business with. This wasn't unusual at all at first glance. Many companies folded and went under after the EMP. New businesses hadn't sprouted up to replace the old ones for a year and a half in some cases. It was the new contract holders that caught his eye. The shipping contracts went to Anchor Riverboat Company and the Appalachian Express Railroad Company. There were services rendered bills from the Martin Hale Security Company, and more bills from a Bachman detention facility. Martin Hale was a new player on the scene, and he was unfortunate enough to have come across a couple of these so-called security men when the trading railroad began to employ two of them on their routes as protection. They felt more like hired thugs than law enforcement to him. He'd never heard of Bachman Detention Facility, and he knew damn near every state and privately run prison in West Virginia. Anchor Riverboat and Appalachian Express Railroad. Sutherland said they were Tweed-owned companies. If he had to hazard a guess, Martin Hale and Bachman were as well. All signs of favoritism, but it wasn't the kind of dirt he needed to bring Tweed down for good. Setting the invoices aside, he picked up the stack of letters he found inside the leather-bound notebook. There must have been 50 letters, and he quickly picked up on a recurring theme. All of the letters were inquiries about prisoners that should have been released once their sentences were complete, but had never returned home. Mothers, fathers, siblings, and wives, all inquiring about the location of their loved ones. It didn't make any sense to Howell. With resources as tight as they had been after the EMP, most prisons had cut a lot of nonviolent offenders loose just so that they wouldn't be a burden to the system. For the most part, if you were still in prison after the EMP, there was a good chance that you were a hardened criminal, psychopath, or murderer. The judicial system just didn't have time to waste with recreational pot smokers and other small-time offenders. Was that why Metz had turned beet red when Howell asked him about Seth Ferguson not returning home after prison? Seth's disappearance had been meant as a pretext to dig up dirt on Tweed. Had he inadvertently stumbled upon something more? The new warden and the old were covering something up. Of that much he was certain. His thoughts went back to Bachman Detention Facility, the prison he couldn't recall ever hearing of before. What was that all about? Had Dodson been paid to ship prisoners to Bachman? But that just didn't make any sense. There wasn't much money in running a prison these days. Almost all of the private facilities had gone out of business. The state could barely entice anyone to work as a prison guard, which is why they brought in companies like Martin Hale to fill in the personnel gaps. The paperwork answered very little. He now had more questions than he'd started with. Chief Howell gathered up the notebook and paperwork from Mount Olive. With no other leads to follow, there was only one thing he could do. Bring all of his questions to the address listed on the invoices for Bachman Detention Facility, and find out what the hell was going on firsthand. Chapter 13 The sun hung low in the sky. Glowing orange and red light reflected off the mirror-smooth Ohio River as it flowed past the city of Huntington, West Virginia. After 2 days of hard riding, Kenny and Amy were finally at their destination. Kenny followed her through a narrow alley next to a warehouse in the city, skirting crates, barrels, and drums of dried carp stacked up two or three high. The fishy smell was overpowering in the confined space, but the alley provided them good cover. No one in their right mind would navigate the alley unless they absolutely had to. It was the perfect spot to sit and watch, though he had no idea what he was looking for. Sarah might be here somewhere, but she could also be long gone. All he could do was try to figure out where the kidnapped women were kept until they were put on a riverboat and sent away. If she had already been loaded on a boat, there was little chance of discovering where she was. It was his only hope. At the mouth of the alleyway, Kenny cautiously peered out at the street, taking note of the foot traffic and horse-drawn wagons as they made their way past. Down the street another 100 yards, he could see 3 riverboats moored at a pier next to the river. Wagon loads of goods were being loaded and unloaded from the ships by dozens of laborers, their shirts dripping with sweat from the stifling heat. After several minutes of watching, something across the street caught his eye, and he pointed it out to his mother. "Look across the street at that warehouse. See those 2 Martin Hale men guarding the front? I counted 4 more Martin Hale men coming in and out of that building since we got here. If Sarah's still here, that's got to be where she is. I just hope we aren't too late," Kenny said.
"We'll tackle that problem when we get to it. For now, all we can do is try to locate her. You're right about the warehouse. If the riverboats only take the kidnapped girls away once a week, they would need somewhere to keep them under guard. That building is too heavily guarded to be a regular warehouse."
"Come on, let's go around back and see if there's another way in," Kenny said.
They didn't want to be too obvious about their intentions and walk directly across the street. Kenny led Amy through back alleys and walked several streets up from the warehouse before cutting across the main thoroughfare. Once across the street, they went behind the warehouses, keeping an eye out for the Martin Hale security guards. Now that he was closer, he could see a way inside, The warehouse was 2 stories tall and had windows that wrapped all the way around the side and back of the building. The windows on the upper level were propped open a few inches to allow air to circulate through the building. Discarded wooden crates and barrels were strewn about the alley. If they could stack a few of them up, he and his mother could climb inside.
Mom, go take a look in the window and see if there are any guards inside. I'll stack up some of those crates so we can climb in through the open windows on the second floor.
Got it. Be careful, Kenny. Try not to make too much noise, she said.
Kenny slid through the alley, alert and ready to move quickly if a Martinhale guard happened to come through on a patrol. He pushed a large wooden crate across the alley underneath the open window and stacked a smaller crate on top of it, but it still wasn't tall enough for him to reach the upper window. Kenny hefted a sturdy wooden barrel on top of the 2 crates. He was about to climb up on top of the barrel when he felt a tug at his pant leg.
Kenny, I don't see any guards. Let me get up there. You're better at hiding. You stay here and keep watch.
All right,
he said, stepping down from the shaky platform. His mother climbed up, nimble as a cat, and pushed the window above her all the way open. She pulled herself up to the edge of the window frame, tipped the top half of her body inside, and then pulled her legs in afterward. A second later, she popped her head out the window, calling down to him quietly.
Move these boxes back where you got them, or someone will notice, she said.
Before he could ask what he was supposed to do if someone came along, she had already left the window. Kenny disassembled his staircase to the second window, putting the barrel and crates back where he found them. Looking around for a hiding spot, he squeezed behind a couple of barrels, moving as far into the shadow of the warehouse across the alley as he could. His clothes were dark and blended in with the dark alley. Kenny reached down and ran his fingers through the mud, smearing it across his face, knocking down the glare of his naturally reflective skin. After that, he sat motionless, using his peripheral vision to check both directions of the alley. Wyatt had taught him, and years of hunting experience carried out the truth, that the most important thing to do when trying to hide was to remain motionless. The human eye, like many other animals, was hardwired to pick out motion. It worked both ways in nature. Motion meant an opportunity or a threat, depending on where you were on the food chain. He slowed down his breathing, tuning his ears in to his surroundings. Crouched on his haunches, he waited patiently for his mother to return. Hopefully she would find Sarah, or at least find some sign that she had been in the building. Otherwise, they were shooting in the dark. If she wasn't here, he didn't know where to start looking. There were 3 riverboats at the dock. The Martinhale man that bought Sarah from Cheswold said the riverboat left with the girls once a week. What if she was on a riverboat that had already left and he was wasting time investigating the warehouse? That would put them even further apart and leave the trail cold. A man whistling a tune brought him out of his thoughts. The tune was followed by the sound of gravel crunching underneath a pair of hard-soled boots, approaching from further down the alley. In the very corner of his peripheral vision, he saw the man walking towards him. He couldn't make out details. If he turned his head, he might alert the man to his presence. He would sit still and wait. The whistling man kept coming down the alley, scuffling rocks under his boots as he went. As he came into view, Kenny saw that he wore a Martinhale uniform. The man looked down at the ground as he walked, appearing bored as he made his rounds. Kenny's nose began to itch, and the itch turned into the tickling sensation, the kind that came just before a sneeze. He closed his eyes, shutting out all sensations, willing his body to shut the sneeze down and disobey the sensation in his nostrils. Just a few more feet, and the man would pass him by. He could make it. He just had to resist the urge long enough, and the feeling would pass. The whistling man ceased his tune and stopped abruptly a few yards from Kenny.
How in the hell did that happen? He muttered to himself.
Kenny, terrified that the man had made out his hiding spot, opened his eyes a fraction of an inch, still fighting the urge to sneeze. The man looked straight up at the wide-open window on the second floor, clearly puzzled. Kenny wondered how the man had noticed that the window was open, and then Kenny saw that the window was reflecting the dying sunlight, illuminating a patch of dirt in the middle of the alley.
Huh, some idiot left the window open. Probably Jake. Ah, forget it, I'll go close it myself,
the whistling man said. He looked around for a moment and then left the alley by the same direction he arrived. As the guard rounded the corner of the alley and disappeared from sight, Kenny scurried out of his hiding spot and ran across to the first-story window across the alley. He scanned the interior of the building, squinting to see by the dim kerosene lantern light inside the building. In the middle of the room, a central stairway led up to the second floor. The stairwell and second floor were more brightly lit than the rest of the warehouse. He spotted his mother creeping down the stairs. Panic set in. He had to alert her that the Martinhale guard was coming into the warehouse to shut the window, but she was too far away to hear him unless he shouted or banged on the window, which would certainly attract the attention of more guards. Terrified that she was about to get caught, his mind raced as he tried to come up with a solution. Inspiration hit, and Kenny dug in his pocket for his signaling mirror. The signal mirror was not much larger than a silver dollar, had a hole in the center, and was polished to perfection so that it reflected a blinding ray of light. You simply held the mirror up and used the hole to aim the beam of light at an aircraft, and wiggle it about as you faced the sun until the reflection hit the aircraft. Pilots could see the reflection from a long way away. While he knew there was a slim chance of ever using it to signal an airplane again, it had proved useful as a way to quietly signal another person. He'd used it one time while deer hunting with his father to catch his attention. His dad had been reading, his nose stuck in a book, oblivious to the six-point buck standing 30 yards behind his tree stand. Kenny tilted the mirror towards the window, trying to catch the dying light of the sun and reflect it in his mother's direction. There just wasn't enough light. In the past few minutes, the sun had dipped down below the horizon. The red glow of the clouds was all that was left of the sun's light. It was too late anyway. Amy was stalking down one of the aisles of cargo, facing the back of the warehouse. Kenny watched in horror as the Martinhale guard entered the room and swiveled his head in her direction. He backed out of the room and closed the door without saying a word. Frantic, Kenny banged on the window as loudly as he could without breaking the glass, trying to get his mother's attention. Clearly the security guard had gone for help. At best, she had seconds to get out of there. Amy turned at the noise and dropped down behind a crate, just as the security guard returned through the front of the warehouse. This time he had two other guards in tow, both carrying kerosene lanterns and pistols in their hands. The men fanned out, each taking a different path and heading in her direction. Kenny watched helplessly as his mother looked around for some way out of the warehouse. From where he was, Kenny couldn't see any way out. She was trapped like a rat in the corner of the building. If she tried to run for it, she would be spotted and outflanked by the three guards. There were no other doors or exits on the first floor. She must have come to the same realization. She waved her arm at him, signaling for him to leave. There was no way he was going to leave his mother here with three guards closing in on her. He ran through the alley towards the back of the building near where she was hidden. Kenny pried at the windows, trying to force them open, but they were locked from the inside and wouldn't budge. The windows were quite old, and the sealant around the edges had dried out, creating a loose seal around the panes of glass. He took his knife out of his sheath and stuck the tip of the blade between the glass and the sealant, trying to pry the entire pane out. One of the guards was a mere 20 feet from where Amy crouched. A row over, he panned his kerosene lantern as he searched the warehouse. Another few steps, and she would be in plain sight. Kenny dug into the sealant as quickly as he could, cutting around the edge of the pane of glass. The knife cut cleanly through the material, and he made quick work of it. He pried at the bottom of the glass and pulled the pane out with his fingertips. Kenny tugged to free the glass, and the pane came out with less force than he thought it would. It fell from his fingers, dropping away from him and against the sill. The glass shattered on the floor. The guard brought his lantern up and looked Kenny right in the eyes. He ran directly towards the window, passing less than a foot in front of Amy. The lantern clearly illuminated her, but the guard missed her in his haste to reach the window. She got up and ran towards the front of the building. Filled with hope, he silently encouraged her to run faster and escape the building. She was almost to the front door when a large shape burst out from behind a stack of barrels, tackling her to the ground. A second guard with a lantern drew near, and Kenny saw that a guard had been waiting for just such an escape attempt. The man quickly subdued Amy, pinning her to the ground.
"Run, Kenny, run!"
Amy screamed.
"Get help!"
Kenny watched helplessly as the stocky guard took a pair of handcuffs from his belt and forced her arms behind her back, cuffing her.
"Lee, get over here. We got her,"
the stocky guard yelled. The guard that had been running towards the broken window stopped and turned back, ignoring Kenny completely as he returned to where the guard had his mother detained.
"What should we do with her?"
the guard with the lantern asked.
"Stick her in here with the others,"
the stocky guard yelled. Outside the building in the alleyway, a Martin Hale guard shouted at Kenny.
"Hey, what are you doing there?"
Kenny turned and ran. He had to get out of here, but he had to get help. Where could he go to find help? There had to be a police station or somebody who could help him. He sprinted, running faster than the security guard behind him. He turned a corner and darted behind a large metal dumpster. The security guard ran right past him, oblivious to his presence. Kenny waited a few minutes until he caught his breath and then ran back to the main street. A short distance away, he located a police station. A gray-haired policeman sat on the steps, leaning his back against the building, fanning himself with a magazine.
"I need help. Somebody's got my mother. I need you to come quick, please,"
Kenny said, his words tripping over each other in his frantic state. The policeman sat straight up and looked him over, a skeptical look on his face.
"Say what?" "At the warehouse down the street. My mother and I have been looking for my fiancé. She was kidnapped last week, and we think she was taken to that warehouse. My mother went inside, and then three men grabbed her. Please, you have to help me,"
Kenny pleaded. The officer got to his feet and tightened his cap on his head.
"All right. Come on, follow me. We'll get this sorted out right now. What did you say your name was?"
"Kenny. Kenny Miller."
"Where are you from, Kenny? Do you know anybody in town? You have any other people with you here?"
the cop asked.
"I'm from Wheeler, and no, there's nobody else here. It's just me and my mother. Everybody else is back home."
"All right, Kenny. About how many of these men were there?"
"I saw three or four of them."
"Please, you've got to hurry." "Three or four men, huh? Okay. Show me where this warehouse is,"
the officer said. Kenny jogged down the street towards the warehouse, looking over his shoulder every few feet to see if the policeman was keeping up with him. A short distance down the road, Kenny slowed as they approached the front of the warehouse. There was no sign of the Martin Hale security guards who had been posted out front earlier.
"This is the one?"
"This is it. There were two men out front earlier, but they aren't here now."
The officer drew his pistol from his holster and moved towards the door.
"Stay behind me, kid."
Kenny followed the policeman into the warehouse, staying several feet behind him as they moved through the building. The warehouse was as quiet as a graveyard and dimly lit now that the guards with the lanterns were gone.
"Where did you see them take your mother?"
the officer said.
"Right here,"
Kenny said, pointing to the spot where Amy had been tackled. The gray-haired policeman looked around and then motioned up the steps with a flick of his head.
"Up here. There are lights on upstairs. Let's see if anyone is home."
The stairway led to a landing, which doubled back into a long hallway with office doors lining the hall on both sides. At the end of the hallway, light blazed from an open office door. Expensive-looking furniture filled the room, and a man in a business suit sat with his back to the hallway, rummaging through a file cabinet behind his desk.
"Shh,"
the officer whispered. He held his finger up in a come-here gesture and snuck down the hallway. He leveled his pistol at the man behind the desk and stepped into the office, then stepped off to the side of the door. He motioned Kenny to follow him inside. Kenny stepped inside the office, his heart pounding like a drum. He looked expectantly at the gray-haired officer, uncertain of his plan.
"Freeze! Don't move, asshole,"
the officer said. The man in the suit dropped his file folder and spun around, surprised.
"This boy came into the police station with a story about somebody kidnapping his mother and his fiancé. You know anything about that?"
"Is that so? Well, I heard some sort of commotion downstairs earlier. I can't say that I know what it was about. After all, I can't be expected to take care of everything myself, can I?"
the man in the suit asked.
"Your men are getting sloppy, Tweed. The boy said there were three or four guards. Three or four? That's not nearly enough to keep watch over a warehouse this size. Maybe it's not just your men that are sloppy."
You must be getting sloppy, too, if some dumb kid and his mother can nearly expose what you've got going on here. Makes me wonder if you're paying me enough.
Confused, Kenny looked at the policeman. The gun was no longer pointed at the man behind the desk. The gun was pointed at him.
Use your finger and your thumb and take that piece out of your holster real slow and then put it down on the desk.
Kenny looked at the policeman with fresh eyes. In the bright light of the office, he saw something he couldn't have seen in the darkness on the street. The policeman's eyes were cold, hard, and distant, a merciless-looking man. Had it been daylight, Kenny wouldn't have trusted the man to help him get a cat out of a tree. This was a man who would gun him down without hesitation if he pulled his pistol out too quickly, and would probably enjoy doing it, too. He slowly removed it from its holster and set it down as instructed. Tweed cast a hurt look at the policeman.
I'm getting sloppy. I'm paying you to provide security in this town. What am I paying you for if not to prevent just this type of intrusion? No, don't put this on my plate.
The policeman ground his teeth together, but remained silent. Tweed folded his hands together on top of his desk.
Don't you worry about your little girlfriend, whoever she is. A lot of them come through here, so it's hard to remember them all. And the other woman. Your mother. She's a feisty one. Bit one of my men's fingers clean off. Before long, they'll both be far, far away from here. I'll put them to good use elsewhere. What do you want me to do with him? The cop asked. Is he going to be a problem? Are the others looking for him? Tweed asked. No, he came alone. Says he's from Wheeler. Send him to the mines and give him the usual treatment. A few days there and our secret will be safe. He'll forget all about this. Oh, and tell the men to get the girls out of here. Get them ready for immediate transport. We'll leave as soon as possible, just in case this young man alerted someone else to our activities.
Chapter 14 Bachman Detention Facility lay in the middle of a valley, hemmed in by steep and rugged mountains on both sides. A long and winding gravel road led through a mountain pass down into the facility. From what he could tell at this distance, the detention facility was little more than a squat concrete block administrative building surrounded by hundreds of canvas tents. There was likely more to be seen, but he wouldn't be able to glimpse the rest of the valley from here. Well hidden by the dense forest growth on the mountain slope, Chief Howell sat with his back to a tree, scanning the valley with a pair of high-power binoculars. His vantage point was too far away to see fine details of the camp below, but one oddity stood out even from this distance. There were no walls, fences, or other barriers surrounding the facility. Nothing at all to define the inside from the outside. Prisons were built with solid concrete blocks, had windows with steel bars and chain-link fences topped by razor-sharp cyclone wire. This place looked more like a summer camp for youths than a real prison like Mount Olive. It was definitely a prison, though. He could see the striped prisoner uniforms from this distance, as well as other men in guard uniforms. Just now, two of the guards followed a crew of prisoners returning to their tents. The forest canopy was a good cover, but it also limited his view. He had to get down there for a better look, but he'd need to be on foot to approach more closely. His horse was just too loud. Howell led his horse through the woods, retracing his steps up the steep slope. A quarter mile away, he found a quiet, secluded glen out of sight from the road, and he lashed his horse to a tree. He stalked his way back down the hillside, taking his time, and moved more cautiously as he approached the facility. Every few steps he paused to scan the woods around him and listen for others. 100 yards from the facility, he spied a portly guard walking the perimeter of the camp through the woods. The man walked with his head down, staring at the forest floor just before him, completely unaware of his surroundings. If he was going to get a closer look at the camp, he needed to look like he belonged there. That guard's uniform was his ticket inside. Howell moved quickly, seizing the opportunity. He inched his way through the woods, keeping tree trunks between himself and the guard until he was just behind the guard. Howell double-checked the woods around him to make sure there were no other guards, and then he closed the last 10 yards separating him from the guard. "Don't move, and don't make a sound. I've got a pistol on you. Howell said. The guard stopped dead in his tracks.
Put your hands on your head and walk backward to me.
The guard did as he was instructed, and when he was within reach, Howell reached out and pulled the man's pistol out of his holster, then spun him around.
What's your name, son?
Howell asked. The guard gaped at him, his eyes as big as saucers.
John, sir,
he stuttered.
John, this is gonna sound strange, but I need you to take your clothes off. I'm going to borrow them for a bit.
The guard's mouth hung open.
What?
Your clothes. Take them off, Howell said.
The man hesitated and then stripped his clothes off, glancing at Howell's gun nervously. As the guard undressed, Howell noticed the company logo on the shirt. Martin Hale Security Company.
Do all of the guards here work for Martin Hale?
Chief Howell asked.
Yeah, at least I think we do,
the man said, confused.
Okay, now toss them over to me.
Howell scooped up the clothes with his free hand, then motioned with his gun, pointing up the hill.
Walk up that hill in front of me. Go on.
Howell marched the man way up the hill, far from the facility and a short distance from where his horse was tethered. He located a sturdy tree in a clearing surrounded by thick undergrowth that would hide the man from view.
Sit down and wrap your arms around that tree. I'm not going to hurt you, but I need you to stay put for a while.
Howell put the man's arms around the tree and cuffed him, then took the man's socks off and stuffed them in his mouth. The guard began to gag as Howell used the man's T-shirt to cover his eyes and secure the socks in place. The man uttered a muffled protest, gagging on his socks, his voice muffled.
Sorry about that. You might want to wash your socks more frequently in the future in case something like this happens again. I'll be back shortly.
Howell stripped off his clothes and donned the Martin Hale uniform, somewhat irritated to find that the portly man's clothes fit him. Satisfied that he looked the part, he marched back down to the detention camp, determined to get to the bottom of what was happening there. Howell nonchalantly walked over to the administrative building in the center of the camp as if he had every right to be there. He knew from experience that the best disguise you could wear was confidence. Now that he was in the center of the camp, the forest no longer obscured his vision, and he could see the entire valley in both directions. Behind him lay several more canvas tents lined up in an orderly fashion. More concrete block buildings lay beyond the tents. In the other direction, the mountain slope had been stripped bare of vegetation. Gravel and dark-colored rocks covered the ground. A curving road with treacherously steep hairpin turns snaked its way up the mountain. Half of the road was unpaved, crushed gravel, the other half laid with railroad tracks. The tracks led to two pitch-black mine shafts carved into the side of the mountain. Dirty prisoners led mules and horses pulling mine carts loaded with coal along the railroad, their faces and bodies covered with black coal dust. A few hundred men in prisoners' garb were busy working on various tasks throughout the facility. Some carried pickaxes over their shoulders, headed into the cavernous dark mine. Others carried crates into the mine, handling them delicately. Another crew manned a large water pump near the entrance to the mine, where several mules were harnessed to a carousel-like contraption that used the horsepower to run the water pump. The pump brought water up hundreds of feet from deep within the mine and sent rivers of dirty black water cascading down the mountainside. It was a labor camp, a private prison manned by forced laborers in a secret location. This was getting weirder by the minute, but it was hardly damning evidence. There were plenty of states where prisoners were sentenced to hard labor for their crimes. Still, what bothered him was that none of the prisoners were shackled, chained, or otherwise restrained. They carried pickaxes and other tools that could be used as weapons within feet of guards. The guards themselves seemed relaxed and unconcerned, as if the prisoners posed them no threat. It was too bizarre not to have some explanation. What was keeping the prisoners from simply walking out of the camp? Perplexed, Chief Howell scanned the mining operation and then turned to walk back to the second set of concrete buildings at the other end of the valley. There had to be something more to the picture than what he was seeing. Hopefully, the other end of the camp would reveal some secret. But he had to hurry. The guard he had tied up to the tree would be reported missing at some point, and the alarm would be raised. Chapter 15 Kenny struggled uselessly against the two burly Martin Hale guards. They had him by the elbows, dragging him through the industrial area of Huntington towards a train. His hands cuffed behind his back, he couldn't slip his wrists out the handcuffs,